Chapter 7. A letter to Jean Baudrillard. All status thy name is pathology, in which the individual body is believed to perceive the social coincidence as a well-ordered hierarchy, in which uttering evil is perceived as a crime. "What is the meaning of it, Watson?" said Holmes solemnly, as he lays down the paper. "What object is served by this circle of misery and violence and fear? It must tend to some end, or else our universe is ruled by chance, which is unthinkable. But what end? There is the great standing perennial problem, to which the human reason is as far from an answer as ever." From the Adventure of the Cardboard Box. To seek out the motives, and most literally the object which is served by motivation, behind the hazards of reality, seems a quest of old times. Objects are viewed as traces of the motives behind reality. As in the work of Arthur Conan Doyle, this reality, where it deduction and rationality is concerned, is disentangled most convincingly by treating it as a crime scene. The crime scene, viewed as traces of reality, leaves the scientist with a clear understanding of means, motive, and opportunity. The greatest crime conceivable in the history of social science could be that the individual body will never reveal its secret. The analogy between the crime and the mystery of the individual sensorium is the factual locus of social science. According to Jean Baudrillard, the perfect crime does not exist, at least not in reality, and neither knowingly. If the crime is perfect, it would leave no trace, and if the world is perfect, we would have no way of knowing about its existence. So, too, does the individual body have continuous imperfections. For instance, in terms of the sensorium, as viewed by Herder and Rousseau, the individual body is incapable of expressing everything it perceives, as the unity of the sensorium does not allow a unity in language. This lack of unity in language suggests that perception through the individual body seems mainly deceptive. Those physical and mental states of being which cannot be communicated hence are unconsented, while doubted because they lack an object in language, as Scarry has reminded us. Individual expression remains deceptive too, ironically, as every subject created as a vehicle for communication could be called equally artificial. Where individual body perception and expressions are concerned, the 20th century can be viewed as an age which is dominated by a rationality syndrome. Within this rationality syndrome, the expression, "But this is what I feel," has no more value than, "This is my fantasy." On the one hand, reality is fully subjected, that is to say, has become the equivalent of pure subjectivity. On the other hand, reality is fully objective, has become the pure unsensed objectivity. Sensory perception, even its visually dominated testimony, at least according to most recent views in social research, has been definitely positioned as purposeful ideological, for instance by Tyler. And, in spite of the awareness of the manipulative character, cinematographic and photographic devices, the testimonial evidence becomes increasingly instrumental, increasingly a trope of clues which reveal the imperfect crime, as Baudrillard explains it. This is the essence of the crime. If it is perfect, it leaves no clue, no trace. So what guarantees the world's existence for us is its accidental, criminal, imperfect character. And it follows from this, it can be given to us only as an illusion. However, this illusion needs to be constructed over and over again to ensure the necessity to resolve the crime. The unity of the individual sensorium would be much too harmonious to leave any trace. This is one of the main reasons that so many images exist of what individual bodies should be. The image of the sensorium, not the sensorium itself, is presented to us by a simulacrum of unity. And, as it is exactly that, no more than a simulacrum, it can be pluralized, differentiated, or sexualized, or collapsed. In fact, one can do with the simulacrum whatever it takes to deconstruct, or rather destruct, its original. The theme of the simulacrum, in spite of Baudrillard's apparent actualization, is therefore not new. It has existed since the turn of the 19th century. For example, Arthur Conan Doyle realized, like Baudrillard, though some 100 years ago, of course, that the perfect solution to the imperfect crime was equally non-existent as the perfect crime. Rather than derealizing reality in his work, Conan Doyle derealized its rational deduction. As a result, after years of puzzling, Sherlock Holmes, the perfect deductive detective, simply had to die. Such a death was met with a collective protest, of course. When Arthur Conan Doyle tried to rid himself of the character of Sherlock Holmes, the Public of Strand magazine did not allow him to do so. He was pressured into continuing a series of stories on Sherlock Holmes, but these later versions, except for two major novels, The Hound of the Baskerville and The Sign of Four, never did regain the enthusiasm with which he described Sherlock Holmes before. Conan Doyle's perception of the world had changed, and the deduction was no longer satisfying. The death of Sherlock Holmes symbolized the collapse of the rational approach towards the sensorium. His stories became more of a historical and critical in character, using shifts, breaks, and fantasy into the description of reality, which allowed for the twists of faith. With this turnabout, Conan Doyle became the first of what would later be called the science fiction writers. Whether it was boredom with deduction or Conan Doyle's shift towards spiritism, we will never know for sure. His criticism of general science appeared as the character of the scientist Professor Challenger, who took on the role of a daring enough to break with scientific humbug and discover the land of the lost, the prehistoric world. In Conan Doyle's shift towards spiritism, contemplated in The Land of the Mist, this Professor Challenger plays the ironic role of the scientist who ridicules the alleged existence of spirits, until he is confronted with the spirit of his late wife and her transmission of an extremely private message, so private in fact that its unsharing nature convinced Challenger of the existence of a spiritual world. Though science and spiritism seem to have signified two different realities, this is not the case. It might be called remarkable that spiritism flourished so much around the turn of the 19th century, and Conan Doyle describes it as a necessary turn to spiritual values as a reply towards the increasingly material capitalistic world. Nevertheless, this flourishing simultaneously occurred with the rise of ideas concerning psychological conceptualizations. The mere idea of a psychological concept enabled general linguistics, for instance, to disembody design and simultaneously reinstall the idea of its arbitrariness. In turn, the arbitrariness of the sign enforced the concept of the subconscious in psychology. This subconscious could become comparable to the crime site, which seemed to produce signs as traces, which could be deduced by language and the language alone, the perfect solution. In fact, around the turn of the century, both spiritism and social science suffered a disembodiment, which reconstructed the crime. It is tempting also to pose spiritism in an oppositional relationship with methodological deductions of scientific nature. It would seem that the two streams of thought and practices would strive for a social balance of a potential conflict between realism and idealism. Yet the similarities between both streams of thought reveal an important underlying motion. Spiritism and general science were, for better or worse, part of the ideas concerning modernism. Both have engaged in a massive production of meaning, and more importantly, both engaged in a dramatic narrative which each in themselves strove towards unity. Not a unity of the body sensorium anymore. No, the ideas in both Spiritism and general science could not maintain their objective status within the acknowledgement of such a unity. For instance, Humboldt's attempt to work with the notion of intersubjectivity can be viewed as the ultimate attempt to reunite the unity of the sensorium through a language of contemporary agreement. The unity itself could not be dispersed with completely, but shifts arose from the crime towards the crime scene, that is to say, from the sensorium towards the narrative of the crime, the mise-en-scene. Imperfect as the world and the crime must be in order to leave its trace, as such, there has become a scene, a mise-en-scene, which reveals the traces. Equally, every change in the direction of interpretation cannot give the illusion of reality without some idea of a causal chain of events. The theories of Gans clearly show that in search for the origin, such an originary event can be invented, in his case rather for the sake of a modern capitalism. But for general linguistics and psychology, such an origin needed to be eliminated. For Spiritism, such an origin would have been far too dominantly connected to the existing religious institutions. For Spiritists, in order to escape persecution by the traditional church, the original event had to be made at least irrelevant, and the accent of the entire movement was therefore directed at a view similar to that of heaven, called the Summerland Swears, a view of the future rather than of the past. Again, a unity of some sort was needed, nevertheless, as otherwise the mise-en-scene could not be created at all. It would lack social conviction. If I were to say that this book is written by coincidence, its value would immediately decrease in the eyes of the public. So too with art, in which the painting becomes more valid through its title and the story created after the fact. And as such, a causality too, free of origin in time, could conveniently like come from the much older tradition, that of Aristotle. As such, from the rules of the Greek drama, Aristotle emphasized one as crucial, which is the unity of action. This unity of action essentially is a living organism, a body image for the incidents which were component parts of the story must be essential to the whole as the parts of a living organism, so that no part can be removed or altered without destroying or altering the whole. In a play or a story, this means that each incident must result either inevitably or at least probably from what has gone before, or must inevitably or at least probably cause what follows, as Aristotle said. One might say, I present you an organism, a body story, and with it the birthplace of a causality that needs no origin, the inevitable narrative. And so, between Spiritism and Deductionism, it was not truth which determined the outcome, but the quality of the dramatic narrative involved. The quality of the narrative is determined by the fact that it creates a mirror of the world, but not of the real world. The components of each story are molded into an organized monocausal determination of reality, which is then presented as an organized picture, the perfect solution to the crime as deducible from the crime scene, the mise-en-scene, or, as Roland Barthes put it once, what Aristotle contributed to modern theater was less a tragic philosophy than a compositional technique based on reason. To Aristo, the plot was more important than the characters involved. These aspects of plot and causality composing the Greek drama are exactly what made the unity of action transportable into modernity. The lack of importance of playing characters and the importance of the plot made it possible to replace the organism by a machine and transform the theater into a real-life modern drama. Equally, it is a socially shared drama nevertheless, though in a rather strange way, as the socially shared aspect was not conceived as an objective, such as the science pursuit thereafter, but as a rather private matter of conviction. It is not surprising then that, for instance, Professor Challenger could be convinced of Spiritism only through the private nature of the communication between him and his dead wife. The narrative nature of science and Spiritism became so technically perfected that the narrative of the one had to rule out the other. Only privacy, the individual nature of the characters, could, and still seem to can, bridge the gap between otherwise causal chain of events, as within the narrative these characters are absent for good reason. The gap between Challenger's science and his wife's spirit equally symbolizes the bridge between life and death, the mortality of power. This mortality, the story goes, cannot be accepted by human beings in general, and, as private conviction has no power, shared theories emerge continuously. Question remains, of course, does theory ever touch reality? Much like Conan Doyle, Jean Baudrillard too stumbled over the simulacrum, the drama of reality, in which the plot rather than the social constructs the glue that binds the drama. We do not seem to be able to escape from the illusion of the narrative any more than we seem to be able to escape from language or death. This seems a result of the production of meaning, and meaning seems to come from the territory of knowledge, or at least the will to know. But even the will to know is a mere passion for illusion, or, as Baudrillard puts it, the absence of things from themselves, the fact that they do not take place though they appear to do so, the fact that everything draws behind its own appearance and is, therefore, never identical with itself, is the material illusion of the world, and, deep down, this remains the great riddle, the enigma which fills us with the dread and which we protect ourselves from with the formal illusion of truth. Illusion, then, but not completely without a universe, as this universe destroys theory as much as theory seeks to construct a universe. With the simulacrum of the universe, causality itself, contrary to the Greek drama, does not serve as a means of ordering time alone. Modernism entails more than the will to know. It implicates the belief in a heavenly future, a positivistic accumulation of science, a necessary accumulation of capital to ensure economic growth, and even this, the belief to liberate that which is oppressed within individuals, hence the belief that causality leads to victory. Causality is the illusion of time. Whether or not material illusion of time is a necessary evil for human existence does not need to be questioned per se, as Baudrillard's explain. Fortunately, nothing takes place in real time. Otherwise, we would be subjected, where information is concerned, to the light of all events, and the world would be an unbearable incandescence. I might add here that if the individual body would be in direct contact with the world through a perception in which all information serves as an equally important, hence takes place at the same time, the chances of a perceptual survival would be zero. Therefore, enlightenment, Zen, Satori, means to think of nothing, and to have an empty mind, or otherwise simply die from a bombardment of sensory impressions. As we know from Roland Barthes, the lover too is subjected to such a sensory bombardment. In the case of the lover's discourse, the language of sensory perception leads to a desolate isolation, quite the opposite of any affectionate unity. But within modernity, causality itself does not implicate a differentiation of the senses. Neither does it seek means of perceptual survival, and if it seeks enlightenment, as seems to be the New Age version of modernism, it does so only for the sake of its alleged higher state of mind. What we have forgotten in modernity, says Baudrillard, by dint of constant accumulation, adding, going for more, that is, that force comes from subtraction and power from absence. Now this, of course, begs the questions, absence of what? Absence, period, Baudrillard would probably say, or one of the most feared conditions by humanity. I would also keep in mind the non-sensed bodies of individuals, absence of time, and therefore absence of status. For modernity always implicates the absolute belief in a higher status of being, accumulation in every sense of the word, always better, even a little bit better than the rest, is better than equal, lucid, synchronized, and spatial existence. Within the social world, language always seems better than the unity of the sensorium. For remember Rousseau, blind, deaf and dumb, which shows that in order to fashion a language for ourselves, we need only one of the two senses by which we are active. And the unity of action is necessary means, the means to convince of the illusion of time, a clear beginning, middle, and end, a sort of a plot which conceives knowledge, not as a Greek allegory, but as a scientific theory. We reflect on the past to manipulate the present and gain from it in the future. At the same time, to be able to do so, we need primarily a theatrical display. This, as theater implicates, allows us to reflect on the past, not on the present, and at a safe distance as well, again Rousseau observed. There are people who sob over tragedies, but never in their life took a pity over a single unhappy person. The invention of the theatre is marvelously suited to flatter our vanity with all the virtues we lack. Both the theatre and the modern illusion provide a substitute, a compensation for the lack of social attraction, for the lack of the glue that used to bind the lost organic society, if it ever existed at all. This compensatory substitute for social attraction is open to suggestion, in the very literal and psychological sense of the word. It does not suggest positive values as social understanding or affection attraction. Contrary, it poses as positive by the suggestion of the nearness which remains at a distance, a more than professional outlook. Whether being the professional scientist, the actor, the artist, or class, or guild, all of that is born from the exclusion of individual perception. There is a nagging sense that it used to be better or worse. The past within modernity implies both. More Renaissance romance, more space, more social revolution, more dark Middle Ages, more torture and more oppression, and less knowledge, the lesser of them all, everywhere. Modernity is characterized as the liberation of it all, but, for better or worse, history itself is always absent. History presents itself through the principle of history, in which the momentum becomes monumental. The specific becomes universal, but as a means to live by, or to die from, as Nietzsche observed. For Baudrillard, liberation itself from oppression of what, he would immediately reply, is questionable. It is my feeling too that the modern thing we generally call liberation is yet another imperfect crime which shields the illusion of emancipation, thereby ensuring liberation never to take place. In Rousseau's words, but with a slight alteration, it would be ridiculous to view the means which enable men to flee one another as the means to unite them. Liberation equals the illusion of language as perfected communication. At the same time, not the world, but the individual body has to be imperfect to leave any trace of existence. Between individual body perception and linguistic expression, the gap is as wide as the gap between a realistic fantasy and a fantastic reality. Two different worlds connected by a vortex of time. Two different worlds symbolizing the relationship between self and other. The work of Jean Baudrillard is, in sickness or in health, part of the Western history of this relation. Though Baudrillard is extremely receptive towards the emancipation of women, children and animals, he still seeks answers in the purity of their motivation. For this purpose, he has introduced a femininity principle which abandons the desire for power. My point is that neither desire nor motivation, albeit angel-typed, is the source of power. Western language has been capable of producing, not through discourse, but through the status of materialism, an endless flow of power traps. Though the sensitive perception of the individual bodies has been misplaced as autism since the midst of the 20th century, as will be shown in the work of Bruno Bettelheim, because atheism itself can only exist within the rationality syndrome, the status of language through the appliance of human relations in whatever kind of material correlation date back to the old Greek influence of Aristotle and his contemporaries. Reanalyzing the works of Artemidorus will show that the categories of a fantastic materialism like language always maintain a higher status than its real physique.